Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 218 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, Pippa Little speaks with Jeff Hattersley about poetry in her African and Scottish childhood, building a career as an early school leaver and her return to higher education, and her approaches to writing.
Pippa Little was born in Tanzania and brought up from the age of six in Scotland. On leaving school at the age of 16, she worked in publishing as a sub-editor and staff writer. She later returned to full-time education, ultimately gaining a PhD in contemporary women's poetry. Her publications include The Spar Box from 2006, which was a Poetry Book Society pamphlet choice, Overwintering in 2012, which was shortlisted for the Seamus Heaney Centre Award, and Twist from 2017. She has been the recipient of numerous prizes and awards, including an Eric Gregory Award, a Hawthornden Fellowship, the Norman McCaig Centenary Poetry Prize, and an award from the Society of Authors. She has also been writer-in-residence for her local non-league football team, Blyth Spartans. I met Pippa in Newcastle University's Percy Building, in the room she uses for her work as Royal Literary Fund Writing Fellow. So it's nice to meet you, Pippa.
Nice to meet you, Jeff, thanks.
Right, you know, I read that you were born in Tanzania and then brought up in Scotland. Your parents were Scottish, is that right?
Yes, both of them came from either Glasgow or Dundee, but my father went out to Tanzania to help with the independence process there, so both me and my sister were born there.
How old were you when you had to leave?
I was six, so I remember it quite well. I started going to school there, and it was a very happy time for me. It was a very warm, hot, you know, beautiful place. I really felt that was my home.
Yeah.
So coming to Scotland in the middle of November for the first time was quite a shock.
Yeah.
You know, it was a bit of a culture shock. And I did feel that was a big upheaval in my life, that was a big line in the sand between before and after. But yes, I'm proud to be Scottish, and I feel I am Scottish.
So have you returned to Africa as an adult, or have you not bothered?
Not to Tanzania, no. I would like to one day before it gets too late, but it just hasn't worked out so far. My son went back. He'd obviously heard stories that I told about it, and he went to teach in a school down on the Mozambique border, and actually went to see the house that we lived in. He went back there, so he kind of did it for me, really.
Yeah. Were you interested in writing as a child, or did that come later?
Yes, I used to write a lot. Me and my younger sister Jane, we used to write stories and illustrate them and make books and perform plays. And I was given a toy typewriter when I was quite young, and I loved that because I was typing out all my novels and my poems. So yes, we did a lot of writing when we were young.
Right. I had a typewriter. I think I got it when I was about nine. And
probably exactly the same model, yeah.
Yeah, I learned to type really with two fingers, you know. And
yes.
I still do that, you know, really.
I still do too.
I'm incredibly fast.
Yeah. It's amazing how fast you can go with two fingers.
It is, yeah. Well, if you've got used to doing that,
yeah.
Touch typing seems ridiculous, you know. I sometimes use three or four now, and maybe my thumb occasionally, but it's basically two fingers and going all over the place very fast.
Yeah.
So how did you get into writing poetry? Because you seem to have been at it for quite a while now, really, you know, a long time.
Yeah, I've really got to say that my father encouraged me a lot, and when I was very young, he used to read us lots of poetry. He loved poetry. Particularly, you know, things like Edward Thomas and Gerard Manley Hopkins and people like that.
Right.
So that's really how I got into it, through him. That poetry was a lovely thing, and it's, you know, he used to read it at bedtime and things. It used to be really, really nice. And my grandfather, his father, did write poetry that was published. He wrote poems from the First World War, which I found very moving when I found them. And I realised that, you know, through that family, there has been a kind of a writing thing going on, so it's kind of fed into me and my sister as well.
So you were reading Gerard Manley Hopkins as a child then?
Well, being read, yes, sort of, yes. Felix Randall, the blacksmith.
Right.
Yes, and then Adlestrop was a big favourite of my father's, and all that kind of thing, you know, and Dover Beach by Malcolm Arnold. I just love the musicality of it, along with all the bedtime stories, you know, the same kind of thing, just really beautiful language and, you know, just kind of excited me. It made me want to try doing it myself.
So you say you left school at 16, you were anxious to get out of school. Did you go into employment then?
Yeah, I was really lucky. I mean, those were the days, this was 1974. That was, you know, I got an interview with DC Thompson, who are the publishers in Dundee. They do things like the Beano and the Dandy and things.
Oh, yeah.
And I got an editorial assistance job working with the fiction department. But then I got moved to The People's Friend, which was fab. I loved that. I was Cousin Tom. Cousin Tom was the children's page. And I used to get letters from children and things like that. So I did that for a few years, and it gave me a really good training in proofreading, you know, subbing, things like that.
Yeah.
Which I've stood me in very good stead all my life, really. I'm very grateful to Thompson's for taking me on, you know, and taking me in.
So, how old were you when you went? You did go to university later, though. How old were you when you decided to do that?
Well, I'd worked a couple of years, I think, at DC Thompson's, and then moved to Manchester, where I got a job with another publishing company, and I worked there for 2 or 3 years. So, I mean, I was a mature student. I think I was about 22 or something.
Right.
Yeah, I thought I was very mature at the time, 23 maybe, you know. Yeah, so I went to Essex. I hadn't got any qualifications. Basically, what I'd done when I left school at 16, we went to an evening class, and I got an A-level in English literature. And so with that and a portfolio of poems, I went down to Essex, and this lovely guy, Joe Allard, said, oh yes, come and study with us. And he was great, and he published a pamphlet of mine a few years later. He had a press called Ampersand Press, and I owe him a lot because I loved university. I thought it was amazing.
Yeah, and you later did a PhD in women's poetry, yeah?
Yes. I finished my first degree, and I was able to get some funding for a PhD, and I found a supervisor, Isabel Grundy, from Queen Mary's in London, and she was really supportive and encouraging. So she kind of supervised me with my PhD, which was in contemporary women's poetry. And she left to go to Canada halfway through, so I kind of finished it on my own. But I managed it.
Right, so what year did you finish this then?
Well, I handed it in 1990.
All right, okay.
I'd been working with the OU part-time and doing literacy work to sort of fund myself through after the funding ran out.
Right, because I think, you know, there's been a big boom in women's poetry sort of since that time, really, sort of, well, maybe starting in the mid-80s, far more women getting published and represented in important anthologies and so on. But your PhD was sort of before that, in a way, really, yeah?
Well, I was working on it in the mid-80s. Yeah, and it was, you know, about Adrian Rich and Margaret Atwood and Anne Sexton and, you know, people like that. So, yes, I was kind of... I'd gone to Essex, and it had a lot of really good feminist sort of lecturers and teachers and things. So I'd kind of got involved with that. And that's what kind of made me want to do this.
Right. And you were also involved in the magazine Writing Women, which I think started in the 80s, as far as I remember.
Yes, it must have been 1980, 81 or something. I remember I was at Essex, and I sent some poems, and they were accepted. And that was a huge boost for me, because it was a very, very good magazine. It published Helen Dunmore and Penelope Shuttle and lots of really good women poets, and I was really proud to be in it.
And you later worked on the editorial board yourself, I think, yeah?
Yes, I did. Towards the end of its life, I was one of the co-editors.
Right, so when did the magazine finish?
I'm not sure exactly. It sort of morphed into Ms. Lexia.
Right, yeah,
Debbie Taylor was an editor of Writing Women, and she kind of changed it into this different sort of thing, Ms. Lexia.
And around this time you were starting a family, really, yeah? Is that right?
Well, yes, I had my first son in 1987 when I was doing my PhD, really, in London. And then I had my second one a week after we moved from London up to Newcastle, which wasn't very good timing. And then I had my third one sort of 6 years after that. So over those years, it was mainly to do with family and bringing up the boys. So right. I still wrote and things, but I didn't send very much away. I sort of got lost a bit somewhere in all of the other things that I had to do.
So you had your first sort of major publication, I guess, would be the pamphlet. It was a PBS pamphlet choice, which is quite good.
Yes, it was lovely to know that.
It was about 2006, yeah?
Yes, that's right, the Spa Box from Vain Women, yes.
How did that come about, that publication? Did you submit it, or was it solicited, or how?
Well, I'd kind of known the Vain Women through various women's groups that I'd been involved with and writing groups, and I knew that they were sort of always looking for new poets. So I sent them something, but they knew who I was, and I was really, really happy when they accepted it.
Oh, some of those poems made it into your first full-length collection, Overwintering, which was with the Oxford Poets.
Yes.
So who worked with you on the book Overwintering? Did you have an editor working with you on that?
Yes, I did. Judith Wilson,
right,
who has now published two books with Carcanet herself. And she was brilliant. She was really, really good to work with. And she helped me a lot in sort of like looking at how to shape. I mean, I sort of made the shape myself, and I'd kind of decided mainly a lot on the order. But she sort of helped me tweak it a bit, just put it more into focus, and also, you know, a lot to do with the sort of the fine tuning of punctuation or things like that. So she had a very, very good eye, and she took a lot of trouble, so I was very grateful to her for that.
Yeah, it was quite quite a minimalist style you had in that book, really, I thought. Well, not necessarily in every poem, but very tight writing. Like, for instance, there's a very short piece called Axis, about your father, which says a heck of a lot in eight short lines, really. Was that what you aimed for, minimalism?
I don't think so. I didn't sort of set out to do that. I think it just, the things I wanted to write about, that was the kind of the form that I felt I needed to use, trying to be very sparse, I suppose.
Yeah.
Talking about sort of emotional experiences that I'm trying to get, sort of pare them down to the bone, really, of what the core of that experience was.
Yeah, that's what I meant by minimalism, really. And does your work go through many drafts, or does it come... I mean, I do know some poets who will more or less say that they write, that what they will publish is very close to their first draft, and then I know other poets who say that their eventual poem is nothing like the first draft. So which category do you fall into? I would imagine the second one, but I don't know for a fact.
Yes, I do work at drafts again and again. I really want to sort of hone it down to what I really want to say. Or if I don't know what I want to say, I find out what I want to say through the process of kind of sort of getting to the heart of it.
Right. And it's very musical use of language as well, I think. Do you read your poems aloud when you're writing them?
Yes, I do. It's a really good way of kind of hearing something that sort of sounds a bit off, or
clunky.
Or a bit pretentious or something. You sort of, I can get rid of that bit, you know. It's a good way of getting to the music of the poem, yeah.
And you've now published Twist, which is with Art Books, yeah?
Yes.
I think in that book there seems to be, well, the poems seem to be, generally speaking, longer, I think. Is that a conscious move towards trying to write longer pieces, or did it just happen?
I think it's just happened. I feel I've got more I want to say in sort of longer lines and more, I don't know really, I don't know how to say it, but I feel like I need to sort of be a bit more expansive rather than kind of being very distilling it down. I think I'm now thinking about how you can expand and where that might take me. So,
and I also thought that maybe the poems in Twist, many of them seemed a bit more political than what you were writing before. Which is perhaps just reacting to the way the world has gone, you know, in the last, say, 10 years or so. It's gone downhill fast, I would say.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
Writers can't really help but reflect that.
Yes.
Because we're all thinking about it all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's something I'm, you know, I'm quite interested in now. I've always been political, but I haven't been able to. My poetry's been a bit more kind of romantic or romanticised, and I think now the different parts of me are kind of coming a bit more together, and I'm able to write a bit more about my sort of political feelings and ideas.
Yeah, it's more a question of, well, humanity, really, rather than party politics as
such.
You know.
Yes.
So has the response to Twist been good, the critical response? Have you had many reviews?
I've had a few reviews. I had a lovely one in the TLS by Susanna Evans, who talked about how it's, like, patterned. But, you know, there's not been a huge kind of, you know, rush to review it,
right.
Which is a shame. But then that's the way it is nowadays. So many books come out and...
Yeah.
I mean, what's been very heartening for me is that people that I know have said to me that they've enjoyed reading it.
Right.
You know, people whose opinions I value, fellow poets and friends. And I wrote it partly for my sister because we'd had some problems in the past. And it's a kind of message to my sister. And I sent it to her and she said she liked it. So in a way, I've achieved what I wanted to do with it because she thinks it's okay.
So where do you see yourself going from here after Twist? Do you have any projects that you're working on at the moment?
Well, I've got an idea for a couple of long sequences of poems that I want to do, and I've made a start on them. One is on death masks, and the other one is about a friendship between two different women from different centuries, an imagined friendship between two artists. And I'm sort of tinkering around with those, but it's quite soon after the book came out and I still feel slightly that I need a bit of time to sort of assimilate things. So I'm not really working on anything with a sort of huge passion. I've been very busy, there's been lots of family stuff going on. So the writing is kind of a bit fitful, you know, fits and starts. But where I'd like to go from here is I'd like to write another book. Maybe I have another two or three books in me, I hope, you know, and just develop and explore directions I feel that I'm tentatively taking and just see where that goes and try new things, experiment, just develop the craft and see where it takes me.
And I saw that you do quite a lot of readings. Do you enjoy readings?
I do. Once I've got up on the stage and I've started, then I enjoy it. It's very nerve-wracking, but I think I enjoy it more than I used to. I've got more confidence than I used to have. And I do love it. It's a great feeling to be able to share your work, and it's a lovely way to do it. And I've been lucky enough to read with lots of really great people. There's one reading I remember, me and Sean O'Brien in Waterstones in Newcastle, and we were being introduced by a very nervous person in the bookshop who apparently this was his first week, and he stood up and he said, "I'm very happy to introduce these two literary heavyweights." Now, Sean and I are both rather round, and everybody laughed, and I thought it was hilarious. We laughed too, so every now and then I think, well, at least I'm a literary heavyweight. I'm not just an ordinary heavyweight. And that was a lovely reading. And then I've also been warm-up for Carol Ann Duffy, which was exciting. And I've read with all sorts of amazing people. So I'm very lucky, and it's a great experience every time.
Yeah. Sadly, though, then readings have become harder and harder to fund, and you often ask to do them for little or nothing, which is a real shame, yeah? Mm. I mean, it used to be one of the ways poets could actually get some money coming in.
I
think I used to make more money out of readings myself in the late 80s and early 90s than I do now.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's true for everyone, except for a small number of poet superstars. A lot of these festivals which have sprung up, for instance, don't offer fees to the writers, you know.
I've read at Stanza, and that was such an amazing experience. And they treated me really well, and you know, paid me well, and you know, I was really impressed by that festival.
Who are the poets that are important to you now? Do you still read the same poets who you were into when you first began, or has your taste and likes and dislikes changed a lot over the years? Do you still feel influenced by anyone, or have you thrown influences off now?
Oh no, I'm still very influenced by many poets. I mean, I started off really reading Sylvia Plath, as many people do, and I've kind of come back to her many years later, looking at her from a different point of view, and I still think she's a very fine poet. But she was a huge influence, as she was on many people. But I kind of grew out of her a bit as I went on. There's people like Neruda, who I just read all the time, year after year. You know, Emily Dickinson, Geoffrey Wainwright, I'm very impressed by. I like his work very much. Edward Thomas. I mean, I'm quite sort of eclectic, really. Carolyn Forché, who was a very, very good poet. Lots of people like that.
Yeah, I read that you've also done some translating work.
Yes.
In what languages?
Well, it's been Hungarian. I mean, I don't actually speak Hungarian. I can speak a little, but very limitedly. But I can read a bit of Hungarian. But it's through Hungarian friends who... I've got a friend who's an editor and a publisher in Budapest. And we've worked on Agnes Nemes Nagy poems and Radnoti and various people like that. And they've been published in Hungary.
You've not worked with any Spanish poets? No.
Well, with my son, because my son lives in Mexico City now, and he is a fluent Spanish speaker, and he is the editor of the Offi Press, so he publishes e-books and this online journal in both Spanish and English. And we've kind of sort of talked about doing it, but we haven't yet. But hopefully it might be something. And I am trying to learn Spanish, but it's taking me a while. But I'm trying.
I just wonder if you had read Neruda in Spanish, or if you just read
in
English.
I have a dual thing, you know, I can look at the Spanish. I like doing that. I do that quite a lot. I've got quite a few books like that, so I do like to.
I just mentioned that because I'm quite into Neruda myself. And I remember when I was younger, I had this snotty teacher at school who said, I mentioned to him that I was into Pablo Neruda, and he said, I didn't know you could speak Spanish. And I said, well, I can. He said, well, you've never read him then, have you?
Yes, I mean...
A real deadly comment, isn't it?
Isn't it? Isn't it?
But then it's probably true to an extent, if you believe that poetry gets lost in translation, like they say, you know.
Yeah. Sometimes it gets found in translation well, and it opens up so many other places that you would never have thought of before.
Right. So I heard also that you're writer in residence for Blyth Spartans Football Club.
I was for a while, yes, for a year. I enjoyed it very much. My husband Bob is a loyal, long-term supporter of Blyth Spartans, so they're a big thing in our lives, and I wrote some poems about, you know, about the different people who play and the wonderful names of all of the teams. They have fantastic names. And then there was a testimonial for one of the star players, Robbie Dale, and I got asked to write a poem for him to celebrate his 10 years being the star goal scorer. And there was a big do at the club. And it was great, when, you know, the disco and things like that. And then the compere stood up and he said, right, sorry about this, folks, but we've got a poem now. Never mind, it won't last long. So I stood up and I did my poem to Robbie Dale. And I think he liked it. I hope he did. We always have a little chat because he walks the same way that I do when I walk the dog. So we always say, hello, how are you? Okay. But no, I enjoyed that. That was really good. because I don't know much about football, but I know how important it is to my family and the fact that it's non-league and it's a real sort of solid part of the community was a really, really interesting experience to sort of try and apply my poetic eye to that.
So do you actually attend the matches yourself?
Or? I have been to quite a few, actually. Usually when it's like pouring with rain and the northeast wind is blowing and it's freezing cold, you know, the usual thing.
So the poems you write for the footballers and so on, would they be sort of maybe more accessible than what you write in your books?
I think so. So that's another kind of development, interesting development for me to kind of try and make my poems a bit more sort of, you know, not so kind of poetic, perhaps.
Yeah. Okay, well, it's been very nice to talk to you, Pippa.
Okay, Jeff, thanks very much indeed.
Thank you.
That was Pippa Little in conversation with Jeff Hattersley. You can find out more about Pippa on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 218, which was recorded by Jeff Hattersley and produced by Conor McPhee. Coming up in episode 219, Robin Marsack speaks with Cherise Saywell about how she fell into translating the beloved French travel writer Nicolas Bouvier and the differing challenges of translating prose and poetry. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.